This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're introduced to the life of an ancient tribe of Africa, the Hadzabi. Their way of life has changed little since the Stone Age. Our guest is James Stevenson. He's a landscape artist. He was working on a job in Africa when he heard about this tribe in Tanzania. He sought them out, lived with them, and was accepted as though he were a member of the tribe. He learned from the Hadzabi how to survive in the bush. And while on a trip into the bush, he was shown ancient cave paintings, an expression of spirituality. Stevenson tells the story of his remarkable experiences with the Hadzabi in the book The Language of the Land, Living Among a Stone Age People in Africa. The book is published by St. Martin's Griffin. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana. Our telephone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. James Stevenson, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, first of all, tell us about these remarkable people. Who are they?
Well, the Hadza are probably one of the last hunter-gatherer tribes living a traditional life in Africa. They still make fire with sticks, hunt for their own food, and have a knowledge of natural medicines passed down through the ages. And it could be argued that they have been hunting and gathering in the Lake Yasse region, Balangita, as they call it, since the dawn of human consciousness, and that their tribal, the lineage of their tribal awareness has been unbroken for thousands and thousands of years, meaning they haven't been taken over by any other peoples because of the isolation of where they live. And they're really an amazing group of people, and they live in sort of the ideal human society in the sense that they're an egalitarian society. They share everything. They live in the moment. They're full of laughter and joy. And like most indigenous peoples around the world, right now they're facing cultural annihilation and environmental annihilation because of the economy of Tanzania, where they live, is growing at a rapid rate. So they've huge incursions of people have come into that area and are chopping down the forest and destroying the natural water reserves or water holes where the wild animals get their water. And so the wild animals aren't coming to those holes, and the huts are having trouble finding food to eat.
And has this situation been especially severe, troublesome in the last couple of years? I mean, has this just kind of ballooned, would you say?
Yeah, it has ballooned. In 1994, there was a huge incursion of people in the Mongola area, which is the southeast section of the lake. And then recently, in the last few years, a couple hundred thousand people have moved into that region. So the huts have been hit very hard in that area. There are areas that the huts are relatively, the culture is still relatively intact. But they're just a wonderful people, and they took me in, and I enjoyed, I learned so much from them. And I guess I was looking for meaning in my life. I met this man in New York City who offered me a job building a garden in Tanzania. On Mafia Island, which is off the East African coast. And while I was working on this garden, I was a young man, and I asked this man who he thought were the most interesting peoples he'd come across. And in his 20 years, 30 years traveling throughout Africa, he said the Hadzabi. And so eventually I found my way to them. And when I first arrived, I had to take a small plane and a bus for many hours. Then I had to walk, and I finally arrived in this town called Mongola. And I asked the people of the town, do you know the Hadza? And some of them knew, some of them did not know. And they said, well, the Hadza, we have heard, come through this one oasis called the Chimchim. And you should probably go there, camp out. Maybe you'll come across the Hadza there. So I went to the Chimchim and made camp, and a few days later, these two young Hadza boys came walking into my camp area, walking out of the forest. And they had these little mohawks and had birds attached to their bodies. And I said, "Are you Hadzabi?" And they said, "Yes, we're Hadzabi." And they were really curious with the things that I had at camp. At the time, I was sleeping in the tent. And so they sat down and threw their little birds into the fire and ate them and asked me to join them. So I went hunting went into this oasis forest and went hunting with them. And then later they took me up into a Hadza camp, which was maybe 5 kilometers into the foothills above the oasis. And at first, when I first arrived in the camp that first day, the people were very wary of me. And there was one young hunter about my age who sort of took me under his wing, told the other people not to worry. And I slept in his camp with his wife and his kids and the two young boys. And then the other hunters that evening joined the fire, and they all slept. And the next morning when I woke up, there were around 10 Hadza sleeping very close to me under the blanket I had. And so then we started to talk, and they said that they're going on a safari to find honey. And they said, "Do you want to join?" And I said, "Of course." And I ended up going on a 3-month safari. And quickly, when you're around the fire in the evenings and talking, you transcend the cultural differences, and you come to this bond. This human bond, and they really became my good friends. So for the next 2 years while I was building this garden, I would go visit them 2 months here, 3 months there, 2 months here. And then in 97, I decided to go all the way, just leave everything behind and go live with them for a full year. And that's what this book is about, The Language of the Land. I went and lived with them for the full year and sort of lost my old self and came to a new understanding of who I was.
One of the things that comes across loud and clear in the book, right from the title, The Language of the Land, is the importance of listening and the importance of stories. And that is really how the ice was broken.
Sure.
With you and these people, telling stories about hunting, telling stories about dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a sense of the importance of stories to the Hadzabi.
Well, really, stories are everything. They are as part of an oral storytelling tradition. And, stories are the foundation of who they are and how they find meaning in this world. And every time I go back and visit them, another story is created. For example, this year I went and visited them, and all the sort of the previous safaris vanish. And the new story is of our safari. So when we returned to the clan, we would sit around the fire and tell the story of what we experienced. And often things are exaggerated. But what the most important part, or what I found most interesting, is they may exaggerate a story, but to reveal the truth of the safari, the trip, to reveal what the group had learned. So to the listeners, they will share or teach a lesson through the story.
Mm-hmm.
Dreams are also very important, and I had a lot of dreams, and I would tell them my dreams, and when I started telling them my dreams, they responded and started telling me their dreams. And for example, they may dream of a buffalo near a certain rock, and this particular rock, the landscape is mapped out. For example, they would wake up and say, "I dreamt of this buffalo near the rock where my grandfather was killed by a leopard. I have to go there today. We are sleeping near there, and I will find the buffalo and kill it for food." And sure enough, he'll tell the story, and he'll go find it, and he'll kill the buffalo. So they seem to be in tune to maybe another awareness that has been blocked off for us by our way of life.
Mm-hmm. Share the story you tell in the book, if you would, about hunting wildebeest. Mm-hmm. You find yourself wondering why you keep returning to this place, and you have a very interesting dream.
Sure. In that particular time, we were in this vast, dry lake bed. Miles upon miles of just this almost desert landscape, and we were. There was a moon in the sky, and when we were in this little womb of grass, sort of within the dry, parched landscape, and the womb of grass is right next to a wildebeest path. And the wildebeest, the hunter knew that the wildebeest had passed 2 days earlier and would pass again that evening. So there were three hunters and myself. And it was just amazing being there in that womb of grass and looking at the stars and sort of re-questioning who I was, why I kept returning over and over again. Was there a reason for returning? Was there, was I meant to be there? And actually, the conversation that I had with him in that grass sort of came out to, we realized that we wanted to try to do something for the Hadza, and they felt that I was called to come there. And we continued to, and at that while we were in the womb grass, I had this vision, kind of like a vision and a dream, of my friend Mustafa's mother. And she had lion eyes, and she was sort of embracing the sky. And she considered herself the mother of everyone, even my mother. And so we realized that after the wildebeest hunt, we should go talk to the mother. And she would be the first guide to lead us on our journey. And she had talked to the grandfather that night and had dreamt of us. And we actually did kill a wildebeest that night, or they did. And the wildebeest passed, and we leapt out of the womb grass and went on this long hunt after the wounded wildebeest that lasted most of the night. And when we came back with the wildebeest, she saw that as a sign, and then she told us that we had to go to this one cave, and she gave us these two medicine horns. One medicine horn was from the mother that would protect me from and protect the two young hunters that were with me, Mustafa, Sabina, and would protect us on our journey. And the other horn was from the father, and that's the horn, the medicine that was in that horn would protect us from the government officials and all the other humans that would try to stop us on our way. So she sent us to the lion cave, and that's one of the chapters in the book. And then from the lion cave, we went on various journeys to, for me at least, for me to understand who the Hadza were, the spirituality of their culture, and understand what it was to learn the language of the land, what it was to know the land, live in balance with the land, and sort of what it was to understand their tribal awareness and their sort of collective spirituality as a tribe. And then I went, went to the cave paintings and eventually to this holy mountain called Nundulugu, Nundulugu was a sort of savior, Christ-like figure for the Hadza. And at that holy mount, we all sort of have a vision, and we come back to finding, I guess you can read the book.
Yeah.
I'll let you ask questions. Sorry, get going. And
no, that's okay. It's a really good story. And, I'm outlining my questions for you earlier today. This morning, I found myself thinking, in terms of, I want him to tell this story. And I found myself, using the words in my mind over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me the story. Tell me the story. Tell me the story.
Yeah, sure. And the story is, this book that I wrote it in 97 and 98. And since I've written the book, I've visited the Hadza over the last 5 years or 4 years. And really, I've taken the full circle. And eventually went back to that mountain a few years ago and sort of closed the circle of experience. But, yeah, I'm amazed by the story, and I feel fortunate, and just it's a great story.
The experience that you had, it has been so intense.
Mm-hmm.
And so personal. How has it changed how you see the world?
Well, it's changed me, I think, immensely. I think I see what is real and what is false. I think it helped me rip through the myriads of facades or illusions. I think it almost destroyed me. In one way, I felt an intense clash between who I was with them and who I was in this world, and had to kind of, I went through a destructive period and had to pull myself out of that and synthesize experience. And so I guess now I in my life, I do a lot of yoga and I try to live simply. I just, it's given me more strength to follow my way, I guess, or understand really who I am, and realizing that every time you come to a new level, you just go to that level and you just keep growing. It's a continual cycle of understanding yourself and finding a deeper awareness of your surrounding and who you are, I guess. Yeah. So yeah, it's definitely changed me.
Do you have to prepare yourself to go there and then to leave there? Do you have to, you know, set yourself into the right frame of mind?
Kind of. I mean, I feel I've been doing it now for close to 7 years, 8 years, and I've been in Africa now for close to 11 years, going back and forth. So I've gotten used to going from one extreme to another extreme, New York City to Zanzibar or to live with him in the bush. So I'm able to deal with it better. But for example, when I come back to New York for the first week or two, I'm usually very quiet and I'm private, stay alone. As a writer, I try to understand the lucidity I gain from going from one extreme to the other, because very soon I get thrust into trying to survive here in New York and making a living, and you get acclimated very quickly back into your old way of life. Mm. And with the hot seat, you just have to jump in. You just have to go there and throw yourself in. But it took a long time. I mean, I had been working in East Africa for 3 or 4 years before I met the Hadzabe. So I don't think, if I hadn't been working in on the one particular remote island landscaping and previously in another remote area, I don't think I could have jumped in quite so easy. Mm.
James Stevenson is our guest this afternoon. We're talking with him about an ancient people in Africa, the Hadza or the Hadzabi. Either term is okay to
use? Either way. Hadza is plural and Hadzabi is singular.
I see.
The whole of the people.
Okay. James Stevenson is our guest. He's written about his experiences in Tanzania. The book's titled The Language of the Land, Living Among a Stone Age People in Africa. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line. Good wherever you're listening. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. James Stevenson, our guest. The title of the book, The Language of the Land. One of the things that is so amazing about these people is the way that they can live in the moment. Life is so spontaneous. You mentioned earlier that you went out looking for honey and you were gone for, you know, a long time.
Yeah, sure.
What is their sense of time, of tomorrow? Do they have a sense of long term?
Well, I mean, they have a sense of long term. They're aware of long term. But in another way, does it relate to our sense in long term. I mean, for example, let's say you're in the morning and you want to walk to a certain area, and you have to talk in terms of, will we get there by, you know, we leave at sun up, will we get there by the sunset, or will we get there by the afternoon? So you talk in terms of the sun. But in the sense of past 2, 3 days, 4 days, they just, if you tell them you're going to come in a week, that could mean one day or it could mean 4 or 5 months. When I live with them, let's say, for 5 months and then I leave and come back 8 months later, when they see me, it's like no time has passed. And they often ask, have you been living with another clan in the bush? So they're aware that I've been, you know, away. But what I found was so great was just their sense of living in the moment, being totally free in the moment. And I've seen two Hadza hunt fighting with each other severely. And suddenly another Hadza comes in with a dik-dik, a small animal, deer-like animal, and they suddenly just start eating, and you see them eating with their arms around each other, and the anger that they had passes very quickly. They don't hold on to grudges. They don't hold on to negatives. Just they let it go. Mm-hmm. They can be very angry in the moment. They express their anger, but then they just let it go.
A listener is waiting to talk with us. Let's talk with this caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. I was very intrigued, and I only tuned in the radio like about 12 minutes after, so I may have missed your description of the people who you lived with.
Okay.
I wondered how they have managed to survive mm-hmm. with, you know, the modern world around them.
Yeah.
And how large a group they are, and what do they do when they interact with this world? And I'm sort of curious as to how you made a connection with these people.
Okay. The number is around 500 Hadzabi. It's a very small group.
And that's a clan.
It's a clan. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a tribe. There are many clans within that clan. I mean, the number, it's from 500 to 2,000. There's been various surveys done, and they're not really sure. I think there's about 500 Hadza living the traditional Hadza life, and around maybe 2,000 Hadza that are living within the towns and also mm-hmm. in the bush and also are mixed with other tribes.
This is Zanzibar?
No, this is Tanzania, central Tanzania, about 400 miles inland from Zanzibar.
Mm-hmm.
And they survive. One reason that their culture still exists is because you have the Ngorongoro Conservation Area right along Lake Eyasi. And it's a very remote area. It was very hard to get to. That Ngorongoro Conservation Area is protected, and that borders on the Massawa Game Reserve and also the Serengeti Plains. So there's lots of animals coming from that area into the Lake Eyasi region.
Which is where they live.
And this is where they live. Mm-hmm. And they live in an unprotected area, but because of the animals coming in and because of the isolation and where they live is very hard to get to, and the climate is severe.
Severely hot.
It's very hot, yes. Mm-hmm. And then when the rain comes, it washes all roads away. Mm-hmm. It's extreme. So because of that, they've been able to survive and hold on to the mm-hmm. culture. And also they're nomadic. And because of their nomadicism, they move to various places. So if they're in one area and a lot of farmers come to that area, they'll just move into another area. But the problem now is that the forest is getting smaller and smaller, the wilderness, so they're finding less places to move to.
And they do not do agriculture themselves as such.
Excuse me?
They do not participate in agriculture themselves.
No, they're neither a pastoralist or mm-hmm. agriculturalist. And in the 60s, when Nyerere created his Ujamaa, which was a brotherhood, which was really to wipe out tribalism, where mm-hmm. he moved people from the north and the south. Nyerere was first president of Tanzania to try to mix everyone up so they no longer had tribal strife.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to make the Hadza come from the bush, and he put the Hadza in concrete homes and brought in these programs to make them agriculturalists, because mm-hmm. the country would make more money if everyone was an agriculturalist or even a pastoralist, and the Hadza just would not partake
mm-hmm.
in that. And because of that, then what happened was there was sort of a prejudice that was created against the Hadzabe, people calling them baboon or bush people or swamp men,
mm-hmm.
often beating them when they would come walking through the towns and so mm-hmm. forth. It's better now. But I think they've survived because of the land, their ability to move, and then their strength as people. And also they have this incredible ability. They're very versatile. And what their weakness is right now is it's hard for them to come together as a group because they really have no chief. Each person mm-hmm. is individual amongst the group. They
uh-huh.
are. And so they just, I mean, there's older people that maybe they'll seek counseling, but not really. They kind of follow their own way, and they live in various families. And for example, a young boy, by the time he's 7, he can survive on his own in the wilderness. So it's hard to bring them together and tell them to, you know, stand together, and you must talk with the Datoga, these pastures are coming in and destroying their water holes. And they'll be very angry at the Datoga because they're aware that the wild animals aren't coming. But then the Datoga come into their area, and they'll ask the Datoga for tobacco and some meat. And you know, they don't really have anger towards the Datoga, so it's difficult for them to organize the central group.
And how did you make a connection with these people originally?
Originally I set out to find them, and I talked.
You did set out to find them?
Yeah, I did set out to find them.
Were you an anthropologist?
No. I was working as a landscape builder on an island.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to repeat, but I was working as a landscape builder,
mm-hmm.
and I was, you know, a young man trying to find meaning, and I also was trying to find a balance with who I was, my spirituality, and I was very interested in the land and living in harmony with the land, and when my friend mentioned these people, it just seemed right, and various serendipitous events led me to them. And I became friends with them, and when I met them, I went on a long safari, and that long safari sort of bridged my friendship with three or four hunters and their families. And every year, I came back to visit those hunters, and would get to know them better. And then in '97, I went to live with them for a full year, and that's what the book's about.
I want to thank the caller for
her
call this afternoon. And we're going to talk with somebody else now who's waiting to talk with us, a listener in Champaign on line two. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. The way that you told the story earlier, it seemed that from your first meeting with these folks, you were able to speak with them freely.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what language you were speaking in.
Okay, I was speaking in Swahili. And I had learned Swahili from working on the island that I was working on as a landscape builder. My Swahili wasn't very deep, but the Hadzabe, now they speak their language is Wahadzabe. It's like a click language similar to the Khoisan and Bushmen of South Africa. But they've adopted Swahili because Tanzania's national language is Swahili, and Tanzania is made up of around 117 different tribes. So of different tribal dialects, so people speak Swahili to communicate. So we were able to speak Swahili.
Okay. Is their own language, I guess what I need to ask is, did they speak Swahili among themselves?
Among themselves, they speak Hadzabe.
Uh-huh.
Wahadzabe, a click language. And they also speak Swahili. They've adopted, the Swahili's been in their vocabulary for maybe 20 years, 10 years.
Have you undertaken to learn their language?
I've tried. It's a very difficult language to learn, but I've tried. I understand some of it. It's hard for me to gutturally pronounce it. But I mostly speak in Swahili, and you know, there's other ways of communicating besides just speaking a language.
Mm-hmm.
We would often I would communicate acting out scenes so forth, but you know, it's pretty versatile when we're talking.
Okay. Celeste, early on, mentioned that cave paintings was part of their culture.
Uh-huh.
Have you seen their cave paintings?
Yeah, I mean, it's argued that it's part of the culture, but they've actually adopted, there are various cave paintings in the area, and Mary Leakey had documented some of the cave paintings in a region called Coley. And they say that these cave paintings were drawn from the earliest, maybe 2,000 years ago to 15,000 years ago. And they're not sure who painted these paintings. There's another hunter-gatherer group not too far from where the huts are, but have gone into more of an agriculturalist way of living. They're called the Sandawi. And people say the Sandawi painted these cave paintings. But when I would go with the Hadza, many of these cave paintings have become holy sites for the Hadzabe.
Uh-huh.
And really, they're probably the only tribe in Africa that interacts with these cave paintings,
mm-hmm.
In the sense of talking to them, performing certain ceremonies near these cave paintings. And they claim that the cave paintings are from their ancestors. And I believe that, although some scientists or archaeologists would, or even anthropologists would disagree, But the Hadza believe that the other Hadza, their ancestors, drew the paintings.
Do the paintings resemble in any... Would you say that the paintings resemble the ones, the famous ones from Europe?
In some way, they're not quite as detailed. Many of the paintings looks like they look like Jackson Pollock collages with animal figures.
I see.
And they have, some of them are layered, where the older paintings are used with a red pigment, mm-hmm. where you have elephant and various animals, and then on top of that you have sort of a white layer of various drawings that are maybe 5,000-6,000 years earlier, mm-hmm. or 5,000-6,000 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it's very interesting. I mean, I think in some ways they're as developed as the cave paintings. Europe, just different. For example, in the cave paintings, you'll have multiple suns. And the Hadza read that these are the different times of the day where you'll see these various animals that are drawn on the cave paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And then you may have a giant mother, a Shaitani, a demon mother who's pregnant. Right next to that demon mother is a buffalo who's pregnant. So they're very interesting.
This is perhaps a difficult question for you to give a brief answer to. But what is your sense of the significance of these paintings to the Hadza? Do they regard them as divine or what?
Well, most of the Hadza, there's various paintings they just disregard. It's not really, they're not so important. But there are certain spots, and I don't know if it's the particular area or if it's a particular painting, but there are certain spots that the Hadza are very afraid of. And are aware of, and they believe the spirits are in that particular area. So they maybe go to consult the spirits in that particular area, or they stay away from that area.
Mm-hmm.
That answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Celeste, I want to thank you for having this fellow on today. This is a really great program.
Well, thank you for
the
call.
Thank you so much. I hope I answered your questions.
Yeah, you know, we're getting here in here to a really interesting area of discussion, because our first caller and the second caller, in a way, really dovetail, because the first caller wanted to know, how did you connect with these people? And stories. It was through stories, largely, and listening to one another. And painting is another way you found for telling stories.
Sure.
And you brought art supplies with you. Tell us about the first time you took them out and began to use them.
Well, the first time I think the painting, mm-hmm. and the talk with the dreams were two very important tools of communication. And I'm a painter too, and I enjoy painting. And so to kill a lot of the downtime, I brought these canvas and paints with me. And the first time I pulled out the canvas and the paints, they were very curious about that, and then I started to paint, and they didn't even ask questions. They just took the crayons and started to draw, and I thought this was great. It was almost like organic poetry, and so they would draw these various images as I was drawing with them, and I would say, and I would ask them certain questions. I'd say, well, what are you drawing there? And he'd say, oh, that's the giraffe that I killed, and, well, what's that? Well, that's the Shaitani demon, or the giant snake that will devour you if you go into the oasis, or that's my grandfather, and these are the baboon that he saw before he talked to the medicine man. So the paintings brought on a whole new realm of questions for me, and a whole realm of answers that I never would have gotten, I think, if I didn't bring out the canvas.
Yeah, it's another way to tell a story, and it's mm-hmm. it's also theater,
sure,
and poetry,
yeah,
and. And also these paintings are almost like maps too.
Oh yeah, they're definitely they're maps of the artistic documentation of each trip we went on, and and I felt with the painting when I was writing the book, I was living in this brownstone apartment down in the basement, and I'd have the paintings all pinned up on the walls, and I'd work on them, and they were helping me understand a different sort of research or different meaning that I couldn't synthesized through just the writing. So to me, the paintings were more in balance with the actual rhythm and language of the land, or the balance that they've achieved with the land.
Mm.
That makes any sense?
Yeah. Now, we've talked about ancient paintings, and then we've talked about the art supplies that you bring with you and mm-hmm. that paintings are made. But if you hadn't been there with your art supplies, would this have been an activity they would have engaged in?
No, they never would have been painting, and I don't think many of them, maybe no one's been painting there for 2,000-3,000 years, I don't know. But it was interesting with painting with creativity, because those hunters that hadn't, the younger hunters that hadn't gone to school, they would freely create and paint all day long, but those that had maybe spent 5-6 years in school just couldn't do it. You know, or they just painted what they had been taught in school. So really, it was interesting. Somehow the schooling that they received sabotaged their natural flow of creativity.
Mm. There are, for our listeners, I want them to know that there are some of the paintings are included in the book, The Language of the Land. And also, I think Harriet, my producer, asked you if we might put up one or two, scan them into our website.
Mm-hmm.
As well, so presuming that's okay with you, we'll do that.
Yeah,
so so listeners can sort of see what we're talking about, because
sure.
this is a limited medium, isn't it? Radio.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing I wanted to ask you about before we maybe go on to another topic involving paintings is this was so interesting. Once the painting is painted and the story is told, the painting is finished. It's almost as if it's used up and
it's done. Yeah.
In that way, you know, is it similar to a sand painting?
Yeah, I think in many ways, as I mentioned in the book, they would just when the painting was done, the painting was done. You know, these guys would just leap up and move on. I had to gather the painting up, and they were kind of curious why I was bringing it along, or they would sleep on it, once the communication was over, doing the painting and the rush. Experience, that was it. And I found the painting kind of similar to the hunting. When you're hunting an animal, there's this sort of psychic communication, unspoken communication that occurs between you and the hunters. And when we were painting, I felt that similar communication going on.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, I wanted to ask another question in reference to the painting. I know that when groups that haven't interacted much with the modern world, that giving them things like alters,
mm-hmm.
you know, alters the way they have lived before.
Sure, sure.
I wondered, does the art supplies impact them in some way so that there's a change in their consciousness?
Yeah, I think, you know, possibly it does. I mean, they're being impacted so heavy by so many negative things. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the art's a positive impact. I think it allows them to express themselves in a way. Just people are creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was great to let people give them another venue to express their creativity. And the huts aren't so attached to the cave paintings. I mean, to the crayon paintings or the crayons. They'll start painting, and then they'll start painting their nails and painting their shirts. And the things that I find are more damaging are the radios and these various other objects that are coming into the towns. And the huts mm-hmm. see the people with, you know, sunglasses, radios, listen to music,
mm-hmm.
and they want those things. And that's what's destroying their culture.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome, questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. James Stevenson is our guest this afternoon. You can read about his experiences in Tanzania in the book, The Language of the Land, Living Among a Stone Age People in Africa. The book is published by St. Martin's Griffin. Has your work as a painter, has your work as a landscape designer changed as a result of living among the Hadza?
Yeah, I mean, I think in every way that I try to express myself, it's changed my perspective. And so, I mean, I've definitely started to paint more. I don't build gardens so much anymore. Building gardens were just a means for me to continue writing and painting. And I think with living with the Hadza has changed my level of importance I place on my art. That doesn't, you know, art's simply a means to gain a deeper awareness of yourself and your surrounding. What's most important is to, you know, try to be in harmony with who you are and with the others that are around you.
Let's talk with another caller, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Jumbo.
Jumbo, salama, baigani.
Jumbo, buane.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good.
I'm curious about the spirituality of the Hadza.
Yeah.
You talk as though they're kind of an existential people in terms of they live for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could explore that as far as do they have a moral code and treatment of others. And I'll hang up and just listen.
Okay. Okay. Those are great questions. Well, the Hadza, they have a god, and the god is called Hayine. And they believe in this god, but he's very far removed. There's definitely an ancestor realm. And they, for example, once a month, they have this moonless whistling dance where there are these fires, not the charcoal, burning charcoal. Two groups, the women are on one side, the men are on the other side. And during this moonless night, they have this dance where the men, so they put on this cape and they put on these ostrich feathers and these bells and they dance and they start whistling. There's a transubstantiation that occurs where I think the men lose their individual self and become this conduit to the ancestor world. And they take on this form and this power comes through them as they're dancing and pounding on the ground. And they start talking with the women, and the women answer them and circle around them. And usually when they dance, if there's a problem or whatever the experiences they've had during the month, the problems they've had, the joy that they've had, the situations that they're dealing with, the ancestors answer them and help them. And, for example, when we would go on these long safaris, we would have the dance first to see if it was okay to go, if the ancestors would allow us to go. So the ancestors are sort of the helping hands. And then they have, but there is a god. They do believe in a god or an all-powerful force. And in their area, there are two mountains. There's Sansako, which is the mother mountain, and then there's Lima Ya Mungu, which is the mountain of God, which is the father mountain. And the Mother Mountain is very severe, and they're almost afraid to go there because of the spirits. The Father Mountain, they will go there, and it's sort of the sacred mountain where they go and they talk, but only a few hunters are chosen to go on these journeys to the Father Mountain, and some of them evidently don't return. And so they definitely have a belief system. And then there are certain trees that have power. Certain animals, for example, or certain areas where they'll talk to the tree or talk to the stone. But that tree or that stone is kind of, a conduit or a vehicle to talk with an ancestor or to tap into this force. And so I guess hopefully that answers the question.
We have to leave it there. We're out of time.
Okay.
I'm sorry to say. Thank you for sharing such wonderful stories with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, and thanks, everyone, for listening, and those questions were nice to answer.
Thank you again, James.
Thank you very much.
James Stevenson has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, The Language of the Land, Living Among a Stone Age People in Africa. The book is published by St. Martin's Griffin. It contains the paintings that we've been talking about as well, and there are many photographs in the book as well. We will try and put up, or we will put up on our website, we'll scan into the website one of the paintings or a couple of the paintings for you, and our website is will.uiuc.edu. Look for that down the line here a little bit, maybe tomorrow or on Monday we'll have that up. James Stevenson, The Language of the Land, Living Among a Stone Age People in Africa.